This is episode 10 of the Pod Rock Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Case, and with me I have my trusty co-host.
How's it going, guys?
Ben Steep. And we're a little rusty. At any rate, we're glad to be back, and we've had a pretty long hiatus after illness and holidays. Mix of both, maybe depending on how much fudge you've eaten.
I don't know if I made it out alive. It was too much.
You're participating by proxy. Is that what I'm hearing? I'm seeing right now as a proxy.
Yeah, isn't that like everybody's thing? Everybody's doing proxy nowadays.
Yes, they're doing proxy. Like they hold up the stupid, like America's Funniest Home Videos. They'll have like the picture of the person smiling on his monitor. It was the most stupid thing I've ever seen in my life. It's like, I don't want to see your face. I'd rather have you in the studio.
Yeah.
I want to see all of you, not just a mugshot on someone else's monitor through my monitor.
Maybe our next episode, I can come into the Case Studios, and we can do a face to face and do it there. That'd be cool.
Yeah. We'll have like a fireside chat format where there's a fireplace, and then we can eat capers and lox.
Nice.
I saw some of those at Walmart. I'm like, nobody eats these things, as indicated by the full display and covered in dust, you know?
Well, it's like spam. I figured that, you know, through the pandemic, you know, the store shelves are all empty. You can't find toilet paper. You can't even find, like, mac and cheese, right? But damn if there's not spam still sitting on the shelf for people.
That's right. There's no expiration on that. I don't need toilet paper. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, you know.
I make do with what I have.
Cocoa leaves, right? In the backyard? Yeah.
Yes, all the trees I have. I've got some rocks in the backyard. Sorry.
All right.
You can drag your butt across the backyard like a dog with worms.
All right.
We're off the rails, folks, off the bat.
5 minutes in, we're gone.
That's right.
All right, some news I wanted to bring up that I thought was kind of cool. As always, I usually kind of do this bit at the beginning. There's a couple new music, there's actually quite a bit of new music out. There's an all-female band called Plush that is being produced by Johnny Kay, who did Stained and Disturbed recording. They are new. They've been on tour with Evanescence. They were at a big festival with Seven Dust. Worth checking out. I know you're cracking up already. Yep. The music's interesting. I think I'd be interested to see where it goes on the second album. The band was kind of one of those put together. We found a singer, we found a bass player, a drummer, and a guitarist, and put them together for the album. So anyway, the band's called Plush. The other thing I want to bring up is Nita Strauss. She did a song with David Draymond, Dead Inside. It's pretty cool. Go check it out if you haven't heard her stuff, even without that. She's a very talented guitar player. And, of course, Queensryche News, because I'm a fan. They're back in the studio, and they'll be releasing an album hopefully here in 2022. And Scott Rockenfield has once again joined the ranks of the Tate and sued the band. So we'll see how that one turns out. Yeah. Yep. It's gonna get dirty. It always does.
Boy, that's.
Well, it's, you know, two original members. The other ones have kind of rotated. They got back in the lineup. Mike Stone. I think we talked about that on our last podcast. Yeah. So anyway, wanted to bring that stuff up. Those are kind of some highlights that stood out to me in the past couple of weeks that I checked out. So. Enjoy. But the topic du jour, Justin, you sent me a almost 10 minute or 11 minute YouTube video of a guy that I thought was amazing back then. And when I say back then, I'm going to date myself in the 80s. Mr. John Sykes.
The King John Sykes, yes, of the mid 80s. You know, it was great. You know, I was just a little kid. You know, I didn't know who was what. But I remember hearing some of the White Snake hits on the radio after he had joined the fold. And thanks to the modern age, if you will, and the fact that we have YouTube and various folks are putting up old live, you know, clips and footage of concerts from that time period. It's great to be able to see what other people saw live. Unfortunately, we're not able to have the exact experience, but they're digging up these archives, and it's great. And so one of those archives, as Ben had just described, was this guitar solo. And, you know, I think it was amazing to see John Sykes using a Les Paul. It's a late 70s model, and I think it's a 78. It's a black Les Paul custom. And he played through a Mesa. I don't know that exact concert, if he's playing through Mesa Boogie Coliseum or not, but he had changed his amp preferences through the years. But his faithful acts, he's used all the way through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, pretty much all the Whitesnake recordings, was a 78 model. It was a Gibson Les Paul custom. And it was really neat because he's got like a mirror pick guard on there. And it's got so much mileage on it that the back of the body is down to the mahogany, which is a really cool wood to see, just the natural grain of it and the fact it's worn that much. But, you know, it makes me think about a lot of the players in that time period that were, all these companies were like, hey, play our stuff. And you see John Sykes is like, he knows what he likes. He's got a guitar that's essentially a faithful companion, and it's what he needs. And now, that's not the only guitar he played, but, I mean, it's neat to see this is like his go-to axe. And so, I did look at some of those Mesa Boogie Coliseum heads, like, you know, pictures, and because I don't know that they're that common anymore. They're probably more of a sought-after collector amp, but they were one of the early 80s model amp that Mesa Boogie had. And, you know, because they were doing the Mark series, of course, they had. And I don't know that they were necessarily doing preamps yet. I'd have to go back and dig back and see when Mesa Boogie started doing the preamp, the rack units. But
yeah, they had he was using the Mark III preamps with 6L6 power tubes. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. But it was neat to see the, you know, I'm using an amp like a Mesa because I always associated him with a Marshall. But he'd go back and forth. Because I remember back in the mid-2000s or so, I was really like, oh, we have the internet, and I can go find out exactly what he was using at a point in time. And I remember his old website, it's obviously changed since then, it was just chock full of information and pictures of every circuit of his live setup and studio setup as well. And I remember seeing a bunch of, and I don't want to confuse him with some of the other players that I was really researching at the time, but I believe he, and I could probably get in the Wayback Machine later, but he had these Marshall preamps I saw. But I know that, you know, he really liked the Mesa stuff. It's really cool because to see a guitarist like him, he'll go from 6L6 tubes and, you know, EL34s. It just seemed like maybe he just liked the sound of a lot of different amps. And maybe he hadn't quite locked in what he really, really liked. Because now, on his website now, I was surprised to see this, he's actually switched over to EVH brand 5152 amps, and like the EVH 5153, they're a derivative of the Fender. And you know, this was like the final evolution that the late great Eddie Van Halen had established with Fender as a brand for his amps and his guitars. So I thought it was cool. These use EL34s. Now I don't know if John Sykes had actually swapped these out since then for 6L6s, but I remember Eddie Van Halen, he was always associated with 6L6 tubes. Now, for those who aren't familiar, 6L6 tubes are more of an American sound kind of tube. It gives you more of a rounded tone, a rounded bottom end, as opposed to EL34, which are my personal favorite. EL34s give you more of a British sound, and they give you a little bit more, I think, they've got a little bit more of a tighter bottom end, and maybe not so much you know, smoothness when you play, especially with in my opinion, I think with the neck pickup, you play 6L6s with the neck pickup, they get a little too buttery for me. But I like the EL34 for neck pickups because it keeps it tight. But at any rate, if you've got a Mesa Boogie, like I've got the JP2C, it's interesting to play because I've always been an EL34 guy. This is the first amp I've ever owned with 6L6s in it. And it's like your lead sound, your individual notes, especially with overdriven sounds, it's very round, and I'm not used to it. It's almost like playing with a pick that's been worn off versus one that's brand new with a really sharp point on it. And it kind of feels that way, you know, with an amplifier. So I always assumed, going back to the live clip of John Sykes, he's down in Rio. So those of you who are curious can go actually go on YouTube and check it out. Just put John Sykes solo, Whitesnake, Rio, 1985. And so it's really cool because when he plays, especially when he's shredding, it sounds pretty smooth and buttery. So I am making an assumption that he is actually playing those Coliseum amps, at least in that clip.
Well, I knew he was on two albums for Whitesnake. He was on the Slide It In album when they did a re-recording of it for the U.S. And then he was on the 1987 Whitesnake album, which my personal favorite. I thought that one was, top notch, especially for being, young. I still just love that album. There's not a song on there I don't think I enjoy. For those albums, like from the 1987 one, and then for the Blue Murder album that he started a band after he left Whitesnake, for that 1987 and the Blue Murder's first album, he actually did use the Mesa Boogie Coliseum heads with the Mark III preamps. I'm with you. I, listening to that clip and watching the video, I noticed the same things you did. So I don't know what his live rig was, but he's a phenomenal player.
Oh, yeah.
He was with Thin Lizzy in 1983. So he's, he was definitely sought after. The other thing that I thought was really interesting about him was he was almost in Def Leppard for the Adrenalized album. And they decided to hire Vivian Campbell, which we covered him on a previous podcast. And I think we talked about him for a bit, but you can definitely tell his style and his attack and his technique toward soloing and writing riffs, I think for me stood out a ton on that. After the 1987 album, I want to say, and Justin, correct me if I'm wrong on this, was the Slide It In album. And that's when they had Steve Vai, which, took it, it was still Whitesnake and it was very much Steve Vai-ish, which I appreciate that album completely because it's definitely different. But John Sykes.
Oh, you're thinking a Slip of the Tongue.
Slip of the Tongue. Thank you.
Yeah.
John Sykes, I think, for me, was like the definitive 1980s Whitesnake sound and style. And I think a lot of it is because of his approach and what he did and how he wrote songs, especially the solos. What stuff stood out for you for his playing and his style?
I would say that there's a couple of things, okay? Like if you listen to Instill the Night, he's got it's a very, very clean sound. It's just glacial. It's just one of the best clean sounds I've ever heard out of anybody, and he used a Stratocaster for that, and it was actually a 61 Strat. So it's got a small headstock, sunburst finish. Looking at, if you were just, you'd never see him play something like this live, but it's a studio. It's essentially a studio tool because you get that clean sound with the single coils. And so that's how he got that clean sound. And I'm thinking of Is This Love. Sorry, scratch that. Is This Love. Still the Night, he didn't use this. He may have, because it had another, there's a few songs where he had that really clean sound, but Is This Love, there's a passage there in the middle, and then or towards the beginning of the song, and then there's that really awesome harmonized wide bends that he used in that song.
In the solo? And,
yeah, it's got a really high mid-range to it. It's, he probably used a neck pickup, but it's just amazing. And then on the solo, you hear it again. He's got that tone. It almost sounds like the treble's rolled back, but it's got this sweet singing tone to it.
Those ghost notes on like almost the first note for the solo, it grabs you.
It does. There's something they did, and I'm going to give him total credit. It's in his hands. I mean, they double tracked it, of course. But if you listen to the solo, you know, it's a single track, but it's got that real mid-range kind of sweetness to it. And it's just amazing. And, you know, you hear that tone when he plays really, really fast passages too, and it works. It's like a jack of all trades lead sound. It's just amazing. And so, but that always hit me when I was like a little kid and I heard that song and I heard that tone on Is This Love. I was like, there's something, like you said, about this tone. It just grabs you, and it stayed with me. And I guess the best way I could put it into words that it grabbed me as a listener, even as a little kid, it was like, I was like, there was no one else that sounded, had that tone. There was a million guys that were out, you know, like ZZ Top was still super popular. They were on the radio all the time. Of course, Van Halen, Monsters, and they were just incredible. But then, like, this guy single-handedly, like, in my opinion, took them to a whole new level. And I know that I would imagine that I didn't know those folks. I was a little kid, obviously. But I would say that any internal scuffles, I'm sure the whole rock star life and everything, you and I as fans had heard that time and time again, you know, people butting heads or whatever. All that aside, absolutely, what they brought to the table was incredible.
Yeah.
It was Coverdale's, it was the whole band.
Like, and I said, that whole, you know, 80s era, you know, the Slide It In album and the 1987 album, to me, that's quintessential White Snake, and for that exact reason, the guitar tone, the style, the, you know, the vocals, the way that they approached the music, I think was very awesome and very unique.
Well, I mean, well, yeah, because he came from Thin Lizzy, you know, and there was some, he had more of a blues rock sound when he's over, they wrote those kind of songs when they were, when he was over there in Thin Lizzy, and it was pretty cool. And then, but when he joined White Snake, for me, like, if you listen to, like, Bad Boys, and you listen to a lot of the songs off the first album he did with them, 87, I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, Slide It In was the first one he was on, and then 87 was after that. And I think he...
Right, but I'm trying to remember, Bad Boys, he was on the 87 one, was on off the 87 album, right?
Yep. Yes, it's had the Still of the Night, Crying in the Rain.
Yeah. And Crying in the Rain is a song that 1985 live solo is based off of. It's just like a double dose of awesomeness, because even though the monitors were out, like Coverdale could not hear the monitors were off, he couldn't hear himself sing, cuz so he's singing in a different key. Is what it sounds like.
It stood out to me when he's doing that solo. I mean, his trills and his tremolo picking, and then watching his fingers doing all this stuff is just, you know, it's talent. And, you know, you've heard me say this a billion times. I think most of the guitarists that really put forth their effort in knowing music and knowing how to play their instrument happened in the 80s. It was a gift. I don't think a lot of people appreciate it because they, you know, they think it's either butt rock or hair metal. But if you look at the technique, if you look at the way that those guitarists wrote music during the 80s period, you don't get as much of it anymore like you did back then.
Well, no, and the thing is that, I mean, even audiences in the 80s, a lot of them, majority of them were not music, they weren't gearheads, they weren't guitar nerds or whatever, and they were just people that go get loaded, go to the shows, you know, blow stuff up their nose, whatever. Those people just went there for a party, but there were those that were, like you said, appreciated what they were doing musically. It just seems to me, you know, I'm looking at it from the outside because you and I were just little guys, you know, in the 80s, but it was like, no, looking back on it now, as far as like what I've gleaned from what people have told that were there, it seems like, I think that those guys, it's hard to say, I can't speak for them, but it seems to me that they were very much, really were, got a lot of artistic gratification from the songwriting process, as opposed to now, which a record company does it all for these hood ornaments. They go out there and they have to auto-tune them, and because they can't sing. They have the look, but they have no talent to back it up. And that's not across the board. So there's a lot of cool talent out there that aren't even close to this style of music of like, you know, rock and roll of any kind. But and they can sing really well and write their own stuff. One of those guys, and this is not going to be an episode about this individual. You can go ahead and laugh at me, but there's this group called Dayglow. And I heard one of their songs on the PA system at Target, and I had my wife do that Soundhound thing or whatever where you can capture what the song is by holding up to the PA system. And I liked it because he wrote it in an 80s style. So he took influence from like Hall & Oates from the 80s and stuff. But the guy can sing his own stuff and he writes his own songs. And yeah, it's not Whitesnake, but he's one of the only guys I know of that's actually writing their own stuff, which is cool. And he did during like I even hate even talking about this. Let's just say when everybody was sent home back in 2020, the guy was doing these YouTube videos about how he wrote the song and what he went through, how he got his ideas. That's fantastic, right? If only we could have had that in the 80s, you know, that kind of inside track, I'm sure that it would be very, for those of us who are musicians, that would have been like such a cool thing, you know. But what constantly amazes me about guys like John Sykes and the guitar, the proficient players of any instrument back in the 80s, they use their ear. They knew if they liked the Beatles, they took influence from that and they used their ear to the nth degree. And you'd have guys that go, oh, I like Eddie Van Halen. I'm going to go get all his gear and sound just like him, blah, blah, blah. It's no different now than the YouTube guys that make all these videos trying to show how fast they can shred. And they're in their bedroom and haven't showered in 3 weeks. And they're making these videos about how they can shred. And they sound terrible. Go learn how to play the instrument properly. Take some lessons. Learn how to read and write music. And use your ear for crying out loud. I'm taking lessons right now.
I don't think you can ever stop learning. I don't know. I've told you this. I will never feel like I've mastered even just a 6-string guitar. There's so much to learn. And then not only do you have to retain that, but you have to try to get that creative juices flowing and use what you learn, right? And instead of just, hey, I'm going to play somebody else's lick and look at me, you know, I'm awesome doing it, you know, which I think there's a time and place, because I learned a lot of cover bands too, and I learned a lot of my songwriting came from learning different styles of different music. I was lucky enough to still have a desire to want to learn other things besides just, you know, what was big at the time, Metallica's Black Album or Pearl Jam or Alice in Chains. I think I got a background from my folks growing up. They used to listen to things like ABBA, right, or Saturday Night Fever record, and then I would get Heart or Journey from my dad. So I had kind of a wide palette of music to have an appreciation for, which is great to learn it, but at the same time, like you and I've discussed, take that and use it for your own and write your own stuff, you know, if you're motivated to. And that's the direction you want to take your music talent, because not everybody can play guitar. Not everybody can play it well. And some people have a knack for it. They have a knack for learning. They have a knack to catch on to things. You have a knack for knowing the technical side and wanting to dive into the theory. I've always been on the other side of the spectrum, where I'm about the emotional playing of it and what the feel of it is when I'm writing it and trying to understand it, right? It's about the feel for me. So a lot of different ways to look at it. And we've talked about this on our other podcast that we've done. But I, you know, the thing that stands out to me is that, you know, how things, they say, go in cycles and they go in circles and they always come back around. And a lot of the 80s music, I think a lot of people now are listening to more of it. But for me, when I look and I think about that stuff, it is impressive on how much innovation came out from a lot of those bands that made it big. Van Halen, I can't say enough. I know you can't say enough about him. If he didn't like something, he would try to figure out a way to make it better or find a way to make the guitar to do what he wanted it to do. That's innovation. And a lot of people that grew up in the 80s idolized Van Halen. He came out of nowhere and was just – people were like, I can't believe this guy, right? And I think a lot of those players in the 80s are like that. They just don't get enough credit, or they just don't get as much notice as some of the ones that really stand out. But then again, it's hard to compete when you have someone like Eddie Van Halen that, oh, you know what? I don't like the way that this guitar is doing this, so I'm going to invent a little plug that goes on the back of the E string so I can do a drop D tune right there on the spot, right? Innovation like that, for people like that, don't come around all the time. And I definitely noticed a big shift in that mentality in the late 90s and the early 2000s with the music type that was coming out. It was all about, you know, power chords and focusing more, I think, on the vocals than it was with the technique and the songwriting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, I really liked the early 90s music as far as what was on the quote-unquote rock scene, rock metal scene. There were still a lot of underground bands, and even the ones on the radio. I mean, you had sound. Like, there's some alternative bands I didn't care for. Nirvana, pass. Okay, hard pass. Okay, Pearl Jam was decent. Frickin' STP. And also Alice in Chains, of course. I mean, Alice in Chains was frickin' heavy. They were heavy in their own way, which was cool. Had their own sound. It was awesome.
Huge,
and
I never,
yeah,
huge.
And Candlebox. I mean,
oh, we, yeah.
We've talked about these guys on the show before and everything, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that in that time period, they all had their own sound. There were bands that had their own sound that they weren't copycat at all. And those groups I just named, even Nirvana, I mean, I'm not a fan of their music, but they did have their own sound, and they're considered the pioneers. But what I will say, though, is that let's say guys like John Sykes, he went off and created his own group, super group Blue Murder. And it was great because he had like Tony Franklin on bass, you know, and everything. And I've always been a huge fan of his playing. He plays a fretless bass and it's just amazing. He's on like all the Derek Sherinian solo albums and everything. He's just incredible. And one of these days I want to get him on some of my stuff. And so that's the thing is, like, you know, John Sykes went and actually didn't stop. He just kept going. And he's a creative force in and of his own because he wrote a lot of those songs on the 87 album. And I think that probably led to a lot of the, at least what I gleaned from the things that I've read. And I don't know how accurate they are, but because I wasn't there, but from what I could tell is he was a creative. He's really becoming a creative force in the band, you know, and I think it might've been the singer guitarist, clash. I don't know, but it's kind of like, I think someone like John Sykes, it was inevitable that he would move on to something else because even in other lines of work and business and stuff, you could have a guy, let's say a guy gets a job at a computer company, right? And, or even a company like Ford or General Motors, right? Eventually they're going to break off and do their own stuff when they realize that they are a bull in the cage, and they just want to kick loose and go off and do their own thing because they have so much creative energy.
The driving force, yeah.
Right. And I believe ultimately that's what happened. You could say whatever, but from what I could tell from what he brought to the table, it was only a matter of time before he exploded and just went off in his own direction.
It's different joining a band that's already been kind of
right
established, right? Versus
sure.
I'm doing something creative that I am putting together and I'm doing. And I agree with you that I think Blue Murder was his creation, his baby, his direction of what he wanted, right? Versus being in a band that was already kind of established. Like I had just mentioned before, being in different bands myself, it's a different feel that, you know, when you want to add creativity to something that's kind of already there and established, you do feel like you are participating in it and you do feel like you have some creative input. Hopefully that would be the case for everybody, but that doesn't necessarily mean that music's completely fulfilling what you're trying to get out there musically for yourself. Which, you know, when you break out and you start focusing on the things like, you know, what I do, what you do, write our own originals, it gives you that creativity to do everything if you want to do everything or guide it and do it exactly the way that you want versus, yeah, I'm going to take input from a bunch of different people and then I got to kind of mold around that. I guess to expand on that a little bit, a lot of bass players out there have a lot of talent, and this will be another topic for another show. I just want to touch on this just a little bit.
And we have so many on the way, by the way, folks.
The songs that you write, and I can only say this in the most straight way possible, when you approach a song, write to the song. Don't just try to throw showboating stuff in there because you want to throw showboating. It should be almost like it's a story. It should be its own thing, down to the bass line, down to the drums, down to the guitar lines, down to the guitar solo. If yeah. you try to sit there and showboat in every single song and try to be flashy and everything, you're going to take away from the song itself, and it's not going to be as good as it could be. And there's bass players out there that they're phenomenal, but they don't flash that because the songs that they're writing or the bands they're in, they're writing cohesively and you're writing to the music.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing is, a good bass player is going to stand out, and they don't have to be fancy, like you said, because it's going to show in their ability to interweave their style in the song that's being written. And the thing is that I think when you have a bass player or guitarist or drummer of any of these people that are kind of encapsulated in their own archetype, they view a song that they hear that's partially done, or maybe when they write one from scratch, they view it from how they perceive music and how their signature sound is a manifestation of that. They write in that little world they have. And I think that has a lot to do with you hear about bands and obviously listen to the results of it, where they say it was a winning formula. And from what I've seen, you got like fusion bands and you've got a lot of stuff where they're mixing jazz with rock, all that. And there's so many different subgenres of that, but there's only a few bands out there that come to mind for me that have that winning formula. And Whitesnake had that. And I thought it was great, especially, seeing that live clip of John Sykes. It was like they did the solo for the song that you'd hear on the radio right off the album. But then he has this crazy live solo afterwards, and they put it in. They don't make it part of the song. It's like its own thing. And then Coverdale comes back in, and they had fixed the monitors, and he was singing in perfect pitch with the rest of the music. There's something cool about it. It's magical about that. I'm sure those guys went on the road and did crazy stuff or whatever, but strictly speaking of the music and the performances they put on, I mean, you got to have talent there to start with. And if it wasn't there, then it wouldn't be anything. And it's like when you talked about players that go and they just want to like show off for every little thing, it's going to sound terrible. And the other aspect of that is that if they did that all the time, people are going to get sick of listening to it. They're going to be like, I know you can play. Okay, you made your point. Now, can we hear some songs?
I think it takes more talent to figure out how you can make a chord progression and put it together and sound as good as it possibly can. I mean, there's only 12 notes in the music scale. We've talked about this before too, right? It's how you put them together. It's the different variants of the chords, in my opinion, that make the song different.
See, yeah. And like I said, my approach to that whole thing is that I hear it in my head, and it's like I have to feel it and I have to dig it before I'm even going to record it. I have to be able to play it in my head. I actually write songs in my head, and then the trick is to get them out, to play what you need to get those sounds in your head out, as opposed to your approach. You just play chords, and then you make something out of it. And either approach is almost like they both accomplish the same goal, but it's two totally different types of musicians, right?
Oh, yeah, completely.
And that's why we have conversations like this. We have a podcast like this because, like, I met Ben in 06, and we had no idea that we would even, be doing this now. I mean, no clue. And the thing is that I always wonder if it's different for guys like John Sykes and guys that got started in the profession back in the 80s or even now. I mean, you've got so many different players that do session work. They sight read and play off of charts for like movie soundtracks and, doing studio musician work for pop artists that are known for singing, but you're just kind of doing the music for it, in your small credit on a liner note, it's like, I wonder how, like, I don't know. I always wanted to figure, like, what do they, their life's probably consumed by playing other people's things or having to do this stuff as, like, their full-time gig. And I always wonder, like, you know, does it no longer become fun and it becomes a job? And when I see guys like John Sykes play, you know, live like that, and probably he's kind of been out of the scene for a long time, and he was going to come out with a new album, but now it's been 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, and he recognizes, I saw an interview on YouTube, someone was interviewing him, and he's just like, yeah, we're finally going to get the record out. And it's almost like, are you still chipping away at it? Are you not happy with the way the final result was, and you're refining it? What is the holdup? And I know Eddie Trunks talked about this on his show, and, you know, kind of like, well, you know, hopefully we'll hear it soon. We'll hear it soon. I want to hear it as a fan. I want to hear his new stuff. And he doesn't do, and you know what, quite frankly, I commend him for this. He doesn't do social media. He doesn't do any kind of anything like that. He doesn't do YouTube channels, nothing. He is old school. He goes, no, I don't do any of that stuff. And I'm like, you know what? Good for you. Good for you. Because you know what? When that means when that guy puts out an album up, people notice. At least in the rock scene, they do.
Well, there's the other flip side, right? Do you listen to other music, and does that affect the way that you write? Or are you one of those people that, you know what, I'm just not going to listen to really anything that's out there and just focus on what you're doing, right?
There's guys like that. Malmsteen's like that.
Yeah,
yep.
Absolutely.
He doesn't listen to other players, really. And I've heard Tony McAlpine was on an interview. He was on a, I think this one back when they were touring, and he had stopped by a studio where they're doing a podcast, and I don't remember the gentleman's name was hosting. I'd never heard of him before, but they had a full setup. It was a very nice studio in there, and they're saying, like, shut all the any other music off when you're writing. You got something to say. They don't listen to anything else because they don't want to taint what they're doing and accidentally pull from someone subconsciously.
Yeah,
because, and I can relate to that, because when I hear melodies and riffs in my head that I want to do, I hear melodies first, and then the chords to go with it. And it's really funny because I don't hear drums. I don't hear bass. I just hear a melody. And for me, to be transparent, that's hard for me to write some of the stuff because I don't think about drums. I don't. I hear the melody I want to play.
See, I'm cursed in a little bit different way. When I'm writing a riff, I come up with something kind of cool, and then I start thinking about, oh, what kind of drum beat would go behind it, or what kind of bass lick would be, you know, accenting what's going on, or do you make
But I think that's because you're a metal guy. I think that's because you're a metal guy.
I think it's because I got exposed to ABBA when I was 4 years old, for crying out loud. You know, you listen to different music and it affects you different ways, right? And I will give my brother credit for this. He challenged me, I think, when, oh gosh, I want to say the first time I listened to Operation Mindcrime. He's like, you know, what are you hearing out of it? And I'm just like, man, this is, you know, this is amazing stuff. This is really cool. It's really challenging my listening and focusing on things. He's like, yeah, now try to listen to it and just focus on the drums. Now go back and listen to it and focus on just the bass line, right? And then really kind of start to peel apart that onion that was created, that is a wall of sound that you're blaring out of the speakers, right? That you're really enjoying. And it's a blessing and a curse for me. Because now every time I hear a song, I start dissecting it apart. And I'm like, man, I don't want to do this because I'd rather be the kid jumping up and down on the bed getting the energy from the music. So it's kind of
not dissecting it, yeah.
Yeah, so it's almost at times that I have to, I wouldn't say reconnect with the music that I enjoyed, but take a step back and listen to what is going on and what you're doing as a whole as well. Right. Even after, say you write a guitar riff and, you know, you're thinking about the melody, when you start putting that stuff together, take a step back and listen to it and go, oh, okay, that's what it's starting to sound like. Or, okay, I didn't intend for it to be like this, but this is an interesting direction that it's going, right?
But see, sometimes it happens naturally, because I remember I was with a guy, I had a drummer, he was kind of, he's a beginner, but he could at least hold a steady pattern, right? And we had done this one song, and we'd just jam out ideas, so we'd throw it on a shelf or whatever. And he really wasn't like, he was just kind of getting started as a drummer, but he could hold a steady beat, enough for me to just come up with riffs, just hearing the drums. And what happened was, is there was a song we did, and then he wasn't hitting, he forgot to hit record. And so I came back to next week, because we do like on Wednesday nights, we jam out. And maybe on the weekend we jam out again. So it's like twice a week we get together and jam in his dinky garage he was running. And there was no cars or anything. It was all just, it was full of a drum kit. It was awesome. And so when we were jamming, there was, his neighbors were like, you guys sound amazing. What are these riffs are awesome. And I didn't really think of it at the time. I'm like 24 years old. And I'm like, I'm just coming up with stuff. I didn't think much of it. And it was like, it's just having a drummer there just pull all the stuff out of me. I've got like 4 or 5 discs for the demos. And I passed one on to Derek Sherinian. And he's like, there's a lot of great ideas in here. Because I warned him, I said, hey, this is not really meant for public consumption. And, you know, it's just some, you want to know what else I had. This is what I've got in the, you know, on the shelf. And because I sent one song to him, he played keys on it and everything. It was a really cool experience. And it was like, I sent him something else, and I said, now this is going to sound really like a demo tape, because it was done on a tape, you know, a tape recorder. This is not digital. And so he's like, oh, this is a lot of great ideas in here. But he was like, you know, the drummer's just a beginner, but it was enough to hold me together. And because we're just jamming out, we weren't trying to be serious. And so it was like, those are examples of, like, you can come up with so many different ideas in a short period of time if you just have a steady beat, which he was able to do for the most part. But I was able to work with it and anticipate if the rhythm was off just a little bit. I learned how to feel a groove in my head, because I wrote it in my head on the spot, and not be distracted by what he's doing. And that's why, you know, people are like, oh, you know, let's say they're in a band and the drummer is off beat. It's like, you know what? You should be a solid enough player where you can keep going in your head and not be distracted by that if a hiccup does happen, okay? What if the drummer gets injured? What if he's playing all of a sudden and his elbows lock up or something happens, right? You need to be able to keep going on the song until they fit, you know, for just a smidge, right? If there's like a few seconds problem, you know? And I learned how to do that at a very young age, because I knew what I wanted the song to sound like. I was already on a steady track, you know? And I guess where I'm going with this is that I guess it's just, you know, my writing for that was, I tried to recapture a sound because they didn't hit record. But when I tried to recreate this song, I wrote another song came out, and that's ultimately what I had forwarded on. And I was trying to recapture that song, and I didn't write it down or anything. It became another song. It was amazing, you know, but it's a double-edged sword, like you said, because, it's very important that people, musicians, if they hear a song in their head or they hear a melody or anything, capture it somehow. And it's there for you to work with. So let's say someone says, hey, I want to produce your album. And, you know, what do you got? Well, I've got this stuff that's really not meant for human consumption, but you never know what they're going to say. And if they're asking for it, they're like, just, it's okay. Cause he's like, I've got so many things, Justin, I don't even have finished. You know, I'm like, okay, fine. He convinced me to send it to him. And it's just like, there's a lot of great ideas in here. I thought nothing of it, you know? So it's okay have the courage to spread it out there.
I think everybody will get to a point. Maybe not everybody, at least for me. And I know through our conversations, you get to a point where you feel like maybe you're either just repeating yourself or you're not pushing yourself hard enough, or it just isn't coming out right and it doesn't sound right. I would encourage people to, you know, find someone that obviously that they trust to listen to what they're doing, because you're going to get a different perspective. That's why I bounce my songs off of you. After I've, you know, gotten to a point where I think I'm at least somewhat happy with it and I have a shell of a song. Because when you have someone else give you feedback, they might be hearing something that you're not, because you're so focused on something in the song, trying to fix it, trying to get it done, that you're not seeing it, like I said, taking a step back and listening to it as a whole instead of just the parts and pieces of it, right? Because then you're going to get a sense of the vibe or the feel that you're going to get from it. And like you're saying, those neighbors of the drummer that you were jamming out with, they were hearing it as a whole. You were grooving in your mind on the riff, right? And he was locking it down on the drums, creating that pattern for you. But that outside listening heard everything as a whole, and it sounded obviously really good to him.
Yeah, it blew me away, and I never expected a reaction like that. And at some point, you have to understand that you bring something to the table, even when you think you don't. Because if people that don't, you know, I'm going to say the opposite of what they usually say about the general public. If the general public likes what they hear, then you're probably not as bad as you think you are. Okay? Because, well, they don't know, they're not musicians, and they don't know, blah, blah. No. They like what they hear as a result of what you're doing.
Well, it's because they're not tearing it apart. They're listening to, like I said, they're listening to it as a whole, right?
Right.
They hear a song. I mean, if you want to take Ariana Grande, right? She's got songs out there. Do I necessarily enjoy it? Nah. I mean, some of it's okay, but the mass majority of population out there that like her music like it as a whole. They like a groove about it. They like a lyric about it. That something about it that gets them alive and gets them pumped up and enjoys it for what it is. You know, which goes back to, you know, just looping back, taking that step back and listening to it as a whole makes a huge difference, at least for me. You know, I can get caught up in trying to write something, and I've spent literally, I think, almost 3 hours on one riff, and I got to the point I'm like, I am just frustrating myself because I'm trying to overdo something and I'm overanalyzing something. And maybe I do need to remind myself to take a step back and listen to it as a whole and enjoy it for what it is. I like songs where you can bounce your head, that you can either tap your foot, or that you get that energy, you know, that the musician's trying to get across that pumps you up. And those are the kind of songs I kind of gravitate to and listen to.
It's funny you bring that up, because I think one, there's a time and a place for that. And, you know, people that like to go out to live gigs and go out to bars and places where there was live music.
It's trying to come back. It's trying.
But I think there's a time and a place for that. There's people that prefer to have just rock and music, right? But then you take a song like Right Now by Van Halen, and you go back and you listen to it after 10, 15 years of not listening to it, and you're like, oh my gosh, these guys were incredible. And they were a unit.
I just listened to that again the other day. I love that song, the piano.
There's no
intro.
Rocking beat in there. It's totally an artistic thing, because it starts out with a piano, and there's no drums.
That's so... Yeah, that song is well written. They became like every band, if you stick together long enough, you become a well-oiled machine. At least that's what happens in most cases, right? And you just find that groove with each other, and you know how to play off each other, and you're just in sync. And even that's a thing that could be another topic for another podcast, is when you're jamming out with other people and finding that, you know, that niche with everybody in the band doing their thing. And like you're saying, that's what stuck with you and with the 1987 album, was everything from the lyrics, you know, the musicianship, the drums, the bass, the guitar, everything in it clicked, and it was just on point, right?
Well, you know, it's really funny, because right now my musical endeavors right now are not on the writing aspect, and I'll tell you why. Because I'm learning now how important it is to pay attention to, like, what rhythms are doing, but also whatever notes you're playing in the timing of those, even if it's 16th notes, 8 notes, whatever, to be precise, okay? But then there's also the side of, say, like, you play in a blues band or something, like, especially down in, like, the Southeast U.S., and... you know, they don't really read sheet music. They play by feel. And, you know, they have like the Nashville number system and all that stuff. It, you know, and it obviously works. I mean, they do live blues gigs all the time. I mean, they've got even got stuff that was playing around here. They have like small blues festivals and things like that, like Ritzville and places like that. But for me, the stuff I'm doing now, learning this stuff, the fusion stuff, is number one, it's kicking my butt. I'm figuring it out, and it's teaching me a heck of a lot more about music that I never thought about before, because it's disciplined and it demands a lot. It demands a lot. It really does. And but I can go and play something simple that's four chords and probably fall asleep doing it, you know. And but what matters is most people are going to want to listen to the music that I think is very boring to play, right? I did it for 10 years, and I get so bored. But then they're like, oh, can you play another solo? Play another solo. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to do that if it's not appropriate, you know, because I just improvise up there because nothing was ever thought out. But I knew enough to take a solo and put it in a structure of a space, and we just use signals on stage. I'd get a nod, and I just cut loose. And I knew where it was appropriate to stop the solo. And it wasn't about showboating. It was about having people in an environment where they can have a little bit of hope and peace in their life and leave their problems. So the last thing I'm going to want to do is go up there and be a distraction and be a showboater. And I would tell these guys, I say, listen, I'll play a solo or two when I feel it's appropriate. You know, they wanted me to be playing solos all the time. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. That's not the object of what we're doing here. I'm not up here to be a showboater. And I had to push back quite a bit.
What, you're telling me it wasn't the Just In Case show?
No. They said it should be, but I'm not like that. That's not my personality.
If you play, you know, you playing in a group with a group of people, and I know that some people,
these are all music school graduates. I didn't graduate from music school. They should know better.
Well, some of these people have egos, some of them people don't. But when I guess the point I'm trying to say is when you play with other people, you're not only there to add what you can do, but all these other people, obviously they have something to bring to the table too, right? So why have that ego and why try to focus on one thing?
Well, right. And, you know, it was a really funny thing. And this is not the Just the Case focus episode. This is John Sykes. But I would just like to say that I think when you have experiences like that, it's just amazing how the tables turn. I could be in a situation like this, say, oh, this guy's really talented, he play a lot, whatever. And I'm like, well, that's great. But, you know, think about, like, if you go into, like, you were some of these guys some of the professional guys in the 80s that, like, everybody wanted to be the superstar on the band, and nobody was telling them to go do more. I just think it's weird, and I it probably depends on the time frame. And, you know, when I'm in a group, when I'm playing with a group of, you know, people that were musically trained and they have college degrees in music, I go up there and I was able to fit right in. But then I was able to go further with it because I could improvise. They can't do that. They can't pull it out of themselves. They would just have to read charts. And now, where I'm at now in my life is I'm going back to reading charts and sight reading again. And it's kind of funny. I've come full circle now, but the charts I'm reading now, it'd be like the equivalent of a first chair trumpet player, you know, versus a third chair baritone player. You know, if you're third chair, you're going to play more rhythm stuff and the music's going to be simpler from a time signature standpoint. But when you're, this is fully lead passages or melodies that require a lot of notes to be thrown in per bar, it's quite a challenge. And I just think that music, there's so many aspects to it, Ben, and there's so many different ways you can play it, and there's so many different times when this is appropriate and that's appropriate. It's appropriate not to play too much, it's too little, whatever. I just think that it's overwhelming, it's mind-boggling. To the so many dimensions that music has, the different instruments, the possibilities are endless. And you know what? For someone like me, I'm a very task-based person. And I'm like, okay, we do these four things. Okay, we got these done. You can never be done with music. It's kind of like Newman and Seinfeld. The mail just keeps coming and coming, you know?
There's so many facets. I'll even say, you know, I'll drop this. I'll say it. The kazoo is an instrument. There you go. I said
they have electric kazoos now. You could hook them up to an amplifier.
Do you see what I'm saying?
They sound terrible, but they sound like one of those import cars with a glass pack on the back. That's what they sound like. Put some reverb on there, make it worse.
Well, you know? I think if any message that we continually try to push in this podcast is exactly what you're talking about. Don't think that there isn't an outlet. Don't think that you have to give up on music or it's too hard. There's always something, and there's always something you can grab onto, something you can learn, something you can do musically that can be creative for you, right? And to continue to try to push that side. They don't do that enough, in my opinion, in schools for kids. They still have choir. They still have jazz band, but...
Yeah, they're whittling away at the music programs. They don't think it's important.
No, they don't. And
what about for the kids that want to do it?
You know, it's one of the seven languages, and yeah, there you go.
So is Klingon. So is Klingon, folks.
They get books on it. Come on, there's a book on how to read Klingon. There's a book on how to read music.
Yeah, Mark Morkrand, yes. He developed the Klingon language.
Funny.
I'm a lot funnier in real life than I am on the show here.
Yeah, you're pretty serious sometimes.
You know. Just like sometimes. Music, I have multiple facets, right? I'm the living tribunal. I'm like Manny Faces. I got different faces. Just turn the crank.
So when you're on the podcast, you're writing your metal face, right? You're like, but when you're at home, metal. You're like, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I can death metal growl if I want to, but it strains the vocal cords. But, you know, it's funny because I remember I had a music teacher back in, I don't know, I think I went back to get some music from him. I wanted more sheet music. I graduated from high school, but I still, I went back like a year later and he was still the teacher there. And, I just went in there to go see him. Hey, how you doing? You know? And so he like, I said, I want this. I want the full suite in standard notation in print. Cause this is like, kind of like internet was kind of in its infancy and there weren't any cell phones, like smartphones or anything. But I was like, do you still have that music we did last year? Gustav Holst, The Planets. It's a whole suite, right? You've got Venus, Mars, and Jupiter. And it was a huge gatefold piece of music because there was so much to it. And he goes, you know, I don't have it on file here, but I can send it to you. He mailed it to me, you know? And so I got it. But right before I left that day, he goes, now, have you ever thought about singing? Because you have a very resonant voice. You know, and I was kind of like, no, not really. I never really thought about it. And, you know, I could sing very well, but I don't know where it fits in today's paradigm. You know, I could probably sing like jazz stuff. But I don't know. I wouldn't know what to sing. You know what I mean? It's kind of like I don't have anything to say vocally singing yet. And I wouldn't know with the music that I write, that I have instrumentally, where how I would weave that together right just yet. But quite frankly, you know, it takes a lot of courage to do that. And, you know, I'm slowly getting the courage to be able to do that. But I've got a lot on my plate right now. And I'm learning new styles of music and stuff. And it's very intense for me. And right now, I've kind of got enough on my plate right now. And eventually, I'm going to get, you know, an EP done. I'm going to have it done, have it all professionally mastered and mixed and everything. But, you know, the thing is, Ben, it's just sometimes life throws you a curve. And when you have obligations outside of music, I wish I could be a full-time music guy where, like, that's all I did was write and teach people music and all of that great stuff. I wish I could be in that position, okay? But I think for the paradigm right now, from what I've, like, Blackie Lawless was talking about, he was on Eddie Trunk's show, like 4 days ago. He was on Eddie Trunk's podcast, and he was talking about, they're doing their Wasp, it's just a little bit of a news clip, Wasp is doing their 40 for 40, so they're doing this 40 songs for 40 years, so it's the 40th anniversary of the band, you know, and everything, and I'm hearing all this. But then I went and I watched a press conference that he did over, I don't know, it was over in somewhere over in, you know, I think it was Ukraine or somewhere like that. And they're like huge there. They have huge, the press is there, and he's sitting at this big desk. And it wasn't that long ago. I think it was like 3 or 4 years ago. They don't have a presence in the States. And that's because the States don't know good music when they hear it across the board. But overseas, fantastic bands and legendary bands are treated like royalty. I mean, when you've got the press there, I mean, that's crazy, right? And someone had asked him something. He had a translator there. And so the question was ultimately, what advice would you have for someone just trying to get into the business? And he says, you know what? I have no idea. He goes, I've actually talked to my manager about this. And he manages a bunch of other bands like Iron Maiden and stuff, like road manager. He told me, Blackie, I have no idea. I honestly don't know. Because these guys are, they're still running because they have a legacy. They've got a momentum, a fan base, and a very ravenous one at that. But when you're someone who's just brand new, to catch the ear of players and established musicians that maybe are solo artists, I would think that you, if you really want to excel, you're going to have to put your best foot forward and network, but you're not going to be a rock star. You're going to be someone who gets to work with really good musicians and hopefully ones that you look up to. That's my hope at some point, to be able to be in that arena, but you got to know your stuff, and you can't make excuses for why you can't deliver something. And you don't, some places, like I just watched I sent you links on this, Ben. Bill Leverty was on Jeremy White's podcast. He's got a YouTube channel as well. Great stuff. Check out Jeremy White and trying to remember the other gentleman, Mitch LaFon. Yeah, I think it's Mitch LaFon. Am I getting confused with the Van Halen? Anyway, I'll find it. I sent you the link, Ben, and Bill Leverty was on there, and he was talking about the first time he was going to play on a movie soundtrack, and I do not remember which one it is, but I think he had to play an acoustic part. And there was a rhythm part. But the in-ear monitors, he couldn't hear the acoustic. He couldn't hear. It was a shaker is all they were using for the click track. It was like a click track. It was just a shaker.
Oh, man.
And he's like, I can't hear it, you know. And because he goes, they couldn't have it up loud enough because then it would pick up on the microphone and onto the recording. So he's sitting there playing this thing, and he goes, I just can't get it right. He said it was all, I was like, chang, 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 like, because he can't hear the rhythm very well. And, you know, he's like, he goes, I didn't do it the first time. So the producer's like, all right, come in tomorrow, we'll try again. Next day comes in, I didn't do it. And he goes, all right, the producer's like, come back tomorrow, but that's your last chance, or I'm going to have to get someone else because I got to get this done, right? Because studio time was very expensive. This is back in the 80s. And it's always like, he's like, oh, so he's like, I'm really nervous now at this point. He's already nervous because I get to play on this, you know, this movie soundtrack. It was my first big thing after getting signed or whatever. And so he finally got it the third time, and he was like, oh, so relieved. He's really sweating bullets. And, you know, it's just like, I know how that feels, you know. And, you know, it's just amazing to me to hear stories like that, but it's just really cool. But they're talking about the same thing. They're talking about, like, you know, money, like the, even the guys that they hire to go on tour with them and stuff as their crew, like their sound engineer, whoever got, probably not, I think it's the sound engineer. There was someone, he never missed a date. He'd been working with them for like 19 years and never missed a gig. And then he got sick with COVID stuff, and he's like, no, I feel fine. He's like, no, we got to have you isolate. We can't have you here. And he's thinking like, yeah, this guy's, he's financially not going to get paid, you know? And I mean, a lot of these bands, like if they're not able to go out and tour, you know, they have to diversify and come up with other things. And, if fortunately with modern technology, you can do sessions and play stuff on other people's records and send the files, like, you know, most of the guys are using Apple. I'll just be honest. Yeah. They're using Apple for that stuff. And so, you know, oh, you're going to bounce it. You bounce it. You know, I'm like, so anyway, what I'm trying to say is that if you are one of these players that plays music full time, like you're, you know, if you were like a solo artist who has a legacy and a really ravenous fan base, you do okay as long as you stay busy and you keep involved with different projects. But for those of us that are quite a bit younger and, you know, the music industry isn't as kind, it's going to be a lot harder. But if you're really dedicated, you know, you kind of got to really practice your instrument and get good at a lot of different types of playing, because you're going to have to go find it where you can find it. And there's going to be a lot of diverse, probably, type of music, and you're going to be competing with well-known studio musicians. It's going to be super hard, but I think it's doable. I really do. But, you know, you get, I think as time goes on, you know, unfortunately, you know, circle of life, people pass away and stuff. You know, maybe there's an opportunity there just because of the cycle of life, you know, and everything. I'm just trying to be realistic here. And, you know, it's like, I remember Doug Aldrich, and I know I'm getting long-winded here, but I just like to say that, like, Doug Aldrich, I remember back in 2000, you know, he got a gig with Dio, and he did, like, he was Dio's guitarist. Amazing player, just incredible. And we'll do an episode on him, because he's just another Les Paul player, just freaking sick. And he was like, I'm 38, so getting gigs isn't as easy as it used to be. And, you know, there's a lot of ageism in the business, and so I think, though, that if you get your chops together, you can be doing some pretty exciting work as a professional player behind the scenes, you know, and who really wants the shallowness of pop music anyway? I sure as frig don't. I don't want to be famous. I want to play with the players that I grew up listening to and collaborate with them is, for me, the ultimate dream gig, if you will. Because you know what? For me, it's the music. I don't care about drugs or alcohol or any of that stuff or partying. I like the music. I want to be create, you know, and that's where it's at for me, you know, and I'll shut my pie hole now.
No, creativity. That's what, to me, music is about, right? You're painting a canvas, you're painting a picture. We're hitting the mark. I want to make sure that we give our respects to our fellow podcast member people that we listen to. We hope this finds you well. Of course, McSauce podcast, Fireside Chat, and I want to give a shout out to Chuck Lynch, just because, you know what?
He's a big fan.
He's freaking Chuck Lynch. That's why.
That's all it's needed.
You got anybody you want to shout out to? Oh, he's thinking hard.
Always. Think a man's rock and roll. I think there's a couple of shows that I like. I like that Jeremy White YouTube channel. Check that guy out. That guy's super cool. He's a big Van Halen fan. He just got he's got an original PV Wolfgang model. Or it's an Ernie Ball. Actually, no, it's Ernie Ball Music Band model. But that guy's pretty cool. He's really responsive if you make comments on his page and everything. And he just had you know, Bill Laverty on there. But he has a lot of really good players on his podcast. He had, like, Eddie Van Halen's longtime guitar tech on there. Super deep dive on setups. And the stories that the guest they had on there was incredible. I mean, it's just amazing. So if you want super in-depth, like, gearhead stuff, even higher-level stuff, the guy covers the spectrum. Amazing. So I'd like to give Jeremy White's show a shout-out.
Of course, before, Rick Beato.
Rick Beato, amazing, yes.
Absolutely, check out his stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I know there's some musicians out there that are doing session work and doing lessons and stuff. So I'd like to give a shout out to Derek Sherinian. He's doing if you've got parts that you want him to play keyboards on, you know, send him a demo. I think it's Sherinian Sessions. But he's out on Twitter, so you can just find out Derek Sherinian on Twitter. Also, a shout out to Tony McAlpine, amazing teacher, just a virtuoso guitarist and keyboard player. He's been a piano player. He just did a recital. So check out his Facebook page. I know he does updates when he's going to be doing. He streams the concert, so you can go in person. But definitely check those out. I went to one, and he was his last recital was amazing. And I'm taking lessons from him, and he's incredible. It's kicking my butt, but it's worth it. So if there's musicians out there that you really like and you support what they do and you want to improve your skills, see if some of your players are doing sessions right now or at least doing lessons and things of that nature, because There's no better time than now to start playing and getting better on the instrument. And don't say, well, I'll do it someday, or I've been meaning. No, there's no I've been meaning to do it. Get it done. Because you say it for another 20 years, and then you're like, well, that was a nice idea. No, don't even put yourself in that position. I don't care how old you are. Get it done. Just get out there and crack the whip.
Hey, I did.
Life's too short.
I had an opportunity to sit down with, speaking of Bill Leverty, I had a chance to sit down with him for about an hour, which was, it was great. You know, he's a solid guy, and, you know, he's musically smart. So I absolutely agree with you. Get out there, find some of those people, or, you know, just keep learning, keep doing.
Well, he even said he's practicing 3 hours a day now.
Yeah.
You know, to keep improving. And so even someone who's a multi-platinum, you know, artist, I mean, it's still important for him to keep going, which I commend that. It's great. And so I'm pushing myself musically. And when I feel that I have a level of skill that I think that I, even the stuff I've already done, I can improve it just because of the knowledge I've gained in the last few years. Subtle things, you know, how important it is to have solid rhythm and things of that nature. So, yeah, I think definitely check out John Sykes' work. You can find it all over the place. I mean, it's on YouTube. You can go on Amazon Music, and he's got all kinds of stuff, you know, to go look at out there. So check out Blue Murder, White Snake, his solo stuff. It's incredible. So
Thin Lizzy, 1983.
Thin Lizzy, yes. Lightning.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh yeah, man, great stuff. Yeah. So
all right, well, thank you, Justin, as always. It's a pleasure. Thank you for everybody who's taken the time to listen to our podcast and have either liked or thanked or even reached out and you know, tried to interface with us. We appreciate all of that. So thank you very much, and we'll catch you on the next episode.
Later, folks.